It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The ballots have been counted and the results are in. People showed up at the polls yesterday for yesterday's off-year election. Here to help us figure out what it all means is Chris Potter. He's the head of WESA's politics team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right, they showed up, but do we have any numbers of how many showed up or percentages?
Yeah, I haven't looked at statewide totals, but here in Allegheny County is about 25%, which is a little below what officials were expecting, but not a surprising total.
Okay, so let's start with some contests in the city and work our way up the ballot. Pittsburgh City Council will get one new face. Bobby Wilson won a three-way race for the district that's mostly on the north side.
Yeah, this is the guy who beat Darlene Harris, the incumbent in that race back in the Democratic primary. That result was no great surprise. He was against a member of the Socialist Workers Party, Malcolm Jarrett, and an independent challenger, Chris Roslow. But if you're the Democratic nominee in the city of Pittsburgh, it's hard to lose, and he didn't.
All right. So Ricky Burgess in Council District 9, he won a four-way race. How close was this?
Well, in a way, I mean, he won with something less than 41% of the vote. So you would say, well, that's not a stunning outcome. But, you know, this result also not a surprise. Mr. Burgess has, over his tenure, not gotten reelected with more than 50% of the vote. And he gets by because he faces a split opposition. Same thing happened here. Randall Taylor and Denise Welch, between them, got over 50% of the vote, but they were taken from each other. And so it'll be another 4 years of Ricky Burgess in District 9.
All right. All other incumbents won handily. Bruce Krause in District 3, Corey O'Connor, District 5, and Deb Gross in District 7. But the incumbent who is leaving office, Darlene Harris, as you said, she's not leaving quietly. Why? How so?
Darlene never does anything quietly, but I think part of the legacy that she will leave behind is she may well be the first test case for the city's campaign finance rules. The city has special rules beyond those in state law that limits the size of contributions and also requires candidates to do monthly reports in the months leading up to the election. Ms. Harris has not filed those reports either in 2017 when she ran for mayor this year. She says the city doesn't have the right to do that. The city's ethics board has taken up the case, levied a fine, which she has not paid, and it is now going to the Court of Common Pleas, where it will be perhaps the very first kind of legal test case of the city's reporting requirements here, and that case will likely outlive her tenure on council.
Mm-hmm. And one other note about a race for city position, City Controller Michael Lamb won. He was unopposed. Your team has focused a lot of attention on the county district attorney's race. Incumbent Stephen Zappala won a sixth term in office. How would you assess the 43% showing by Lisa Middleman, who ran as an independent?
You know, I think there is a lot of excitement amongst progressives about this race. You know, this is the latest example of this sort of progressive insurgency you and I have talked about on the air before, where you've seen candidates like Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato beat out members of the Costa family for state representative seats. There was some feeling maybe that kind of momentum will continue to build and carry her through a general election victory. That did not happen. Ms. Middleman did well in parts of the city of Pittsburgh. She got hammered in the suburbs. And it's not just the conservatives. Suburbs. It's places like Mount Lebanon, a sort of Democratic bastion of votes out there. College-educated voters, if she was going to do well anywhere outside the city and its immediate environs, she has to do well in a place like that, and she didn't.
Yeah. Zappala in his victory remarks criticized Middleman for her attacks and alluded to retribution. Do we know what he means by that?
I certainly don't. I mean, I can tell you I wasn't there at his event, but I can tell you that he's not accustomed to being challenged. This is really his first spirited challenge in 20 years, and you could tell he didn't like it.
Okay. Chelsea Wagner won a third term as controller. Rich Fitzgerald won his third and final term as county executive. He had sort of a surprise visitor to congratulate him.
Yeah, that's right. Joe Biden, the former vice president and front runner really in the Democratic field for 2020 candidates, was in town yesterday for a private fundraiser at the Omni William Penn. And then he made a surprise visit to kind of check in with Mr. Fitzgerald and his supporters, including a lot of people from Labor. This is where a lot of your kind of Democratic establishment was last night at Mr. Fitzgerald's event. And people were happy to see him. He made a few anodyne remarks. And there was no drama in that race otherwise. otherwise. Okay. So that's what you got.
We're getting a couple of new faces on county council. Briefly, who are they?
So we're really getting one big guy, and it's Tom Duer, who beat Sue Means, who's been a longtime representative from the South Hills. That win means now that Republicans have just three seats on Allegheny County Council. Allegheny Council has been around for 20 years. This is the smallest size delegation that the GOP has. They had a change in party leadership early this year, in part because of this sense that they are just not a factor here in Allegheny County. And so I think Republicans are hoping we've hit bottom and now's the time when we turn it around and move back up.
Okay. Several common pleas judges were up for retention, all another 10 years by about a 3-1 margin. Chris, do you ever recall any time recently when a judge was not retained?
This is a deep cut, Kevin, but I think it's not a county common pleas race, but in 2005, Justice Russell Nigro lost his bid. He was the Supreme Court justice, lost his bid for retention because of fallout from the very famous pay raise vote, which some members of the judiciary were complicit in approving. Voters cast him out. That's the only time I can think of.
All right. Much attention was paid to a ballot question strictly within the city limits. A tax increase to help fund maintenance and upgrades for city parks. Pretty close decision.
Yeah. Yes, maybe a little surprisingly close. I think a lot of us expected this measure to pass. City voters in 2011 approved a similar tax hike to help the library system. Last year, city voters approved a countywide vote that failed on the county as a whole, but to provide children's services. So people thought this would win. The Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, the totals aren't in, but it probably spent somewhere between $800,000 and $1 million to get people to vote for this. And they did. And so as a result, next year, the city will collect an extra $500,000 tax and put it into a as yet uncreated trust fund and begin to figure out how to disperse that money across the park system.
Who will decide on that? Will city council have control, or is this the Parks Conservancy?
This is what the big debate becomes now, because there needs to be enabling legislation to sort of take the will of the voters and codify it and create this trust fund. And there's going to be a big debate about how much control city council should have over how that money gets spent.
I want to turn now to some statewide results. Not a lot on the ballot, but WESA's Harrisburg Bureau Chief Katie Meyer has been covering all the twists and turns regarding Marcy's Law. If accepted by the courts, Marcy's Law would give constitutional protection to victims' rights, but opponents like the ACLU say it goes too far and are worried about it would actually impinge on defendants' rights. So, Katie, what did PA voters decide?
Well, PA voters decided pretty clearly that they wanted Marcy's Law, or at the very least, they thought the ballot question sounded good. We had more than 70% of voters vote in favor, a little less than 30% at the, these are preliminary numbers, but a little less than 30% looks like they voted against. So, the Marcy's Law people, they declared victory around 10:30 last night. It looks like even if we get these absentee ballots in, there's not going to be enough to override that. So, that was not an unexpected outcome. I think the polling had showed people, again, supported that language that was on the ballot. But now we have to let the courts decide whether it's even constitutional. So it will not be going into effect.
Right. So that victory might be short-lived if the courts say no. And so when do we know, or do we know when the courts will actually take up the constitutionality of a constitutional amendment?
Yeah, it's a good question. We are expecting them to go back to Commonwealth Court in pretty short order. So we had a Commonwealth Court decision giving a preliminary injunction to the plaintiffs, the ACLU and these other groups. And then the Supreme Court upheld that. But no court so far has ruled on the actual constitutionality. And that's an important distinction. So we now go back to Commonwealth Court and we're going to hear arguments on the actual merits of the case. And the case is about whether Marcy's Law is too broad to pass as one amendment. So that's the arguments we're hearing. Now, I've heard different estimates from lawyers about how long this whole thing will take. Obviously, it's probably going to be appealed to the Supreme Court again. They're saying anywhere between, several months to get through the Commonwealth Court to a year. So, I would assume we're going to get a decision sometime, maybe in 2020, possibly could last until 2021.
The only candidates on the ballot across the Commonwealth were in judicial races, 2 seats on Superior Court. Katie, the latest numbers I saw from the Department of Elections had 96% of precincts reporting. Daniel McCaffrey was first, followed by Megan McCarthy King, then Amanda Green Hawkins, and finally Christy Lee Peck. But the margin between first and fourth is just 90,000 votes. So it might be a little time, maybe later today, before we have two definitive winners.
Yeah, it looks that way. It's a little too close to call right now. And you're right, McCaffrey and King appear to have kind of squeaked out a victory there, but super close. So we're going to have to keep watching that and I guess update everyone later.
Okay. How much attention have the parties been placing on these off-year elections in terms of what they might signal in terms of the party's performance next year?
I mean, I think everybody, you know, looks pretty closely at these elections. Obviously, in other states, for instance, Virginia, there were some very round defeats of Republicans that Democrats have looked at as, you know, a sort of a sign of things to come. Here in Pennsylvania, in Southeast Pennsylvania had a pretty strong repudiation of Republican leadership in Delaware County, where it's been very strong for many, many, many years. So some sea changes there. Of course, we've also seen a lot of the Western Pennsylvania counties get even redder. So, you know, still more of that strengthening of the margins on both sides that we've seen in recent years in, you know, the last decade or so. So nothing incredibly unexpected, I think. But of course, everyone's always looking to see what they can glean for next year.
Chris. Yeah, I'll say about that. I mean, I think what Katie says is right. What you see in these, if you assume that statewide judicial races are just kind of a barometer for raw partisan sentiment. I mean, voters don't go out and, like, you know, say, well, what does Judge, you know, McCaffrey think about how the Terry rule should be applied to police stops or whatever? It's a measurement of that. And as you said, the margin is so close. If you see it that way, it really does kind of prefigure a 2020 election in which this will be a very purple, very narrowly decided state in races like for presidency. Although one wants to be careful. Folks may remember in 2015, Democrats swept statewide judicial races, and we all remember how 2016 went. So these are different races, even if they do kind of set a tone.
Chris, in our last less than a minute, anything that you observe nationally that might inform how you'll cover ahead of 2020?
No, I mean, you know, for us here in Pittsburgh, I mean, it's just going to be enough to kind of monitor what happens with this progressive insurgency we've seen here in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County, but also the counties surrounding. As Katie says, they have gotten redder, even as Allegheny turns blue.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capital Bureau Chief. Katie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
And Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Chris, as always, thank you for joining us.
As always, it's good to be here.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. More than 300 licenses were distributed this year to grow hemp in Pennsylvania. Coming up, we'll talk with one farmer in Beaver County. Plus, a conversation with Lawrence Drake about his book on love, grief, and the experience of Black fatherhood. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, journalist Ida Tarbell was born in Erie County, Pennsylvania in 1857. She grew up around oil fields and was often one of the only women in her classes at Allegheny College. Tarbell was part of a group of journalistic muckrakers during the progressive era of the 19th century. She's best known for her book, The History of the Standard Oil Company, in which she writes about the power of oil tycoons and monopolies. She lectured throughout the region and wrote for many magazines and biographies. She died in Connecticut in 1944. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2017, Pennsylvania lawmakers banned lunch shaming. Public schools were barred from stigmatizing students who couldn't afford to pay for lunch in the cafeteria. But as Keystone Crossroads contributor Emily Rizzo reports, over the summer, the state quietly re-legalized the practice.
About half of Pennsylvania students are enrolled in a program that gives free or reduced lunch. But what about those who aren't enrolled, but still struggle to pay for school meals? That's where lunch shaming comes into the picture. and sometimes the dreaded cheese sandwich.
Lunch shaming exists. It continues to exist because you got the cheese sandwich. We all know what the cheese sandwich means.
That's Donna Bullock, a Democratic state rep from Philadelphia who led efforts to ban lunch shaming in 2017. But over the summer, in an omnibus bill, lawmakers revived the practice. If students have more than $50 in lunch debt, schools can give them cheaper alternate meals.
School districts are using tools that are not just bullying to these children, but shaming families and parents that may be in a difficult situation. And oftentimes it's for very small amounts.
So why the law change? In part because districts are on the hook for lunch debts that in some cases have doubled since shaming was banned. Superintendent Joseph Roy of the Bethlehem School District says debts increased more than 50%. Bethlehem has kept its ban on lunch shaming, but Roy worries some families could be taking advantage of the policy.
It's hard to sort out families that aren't paying because they're really in a tough situation, in which case we know there's enough stressors on families and students, and I don't want to add to that. And then there were some that can pay that just aren't responding. So it's hard to sort out who's who.
Bethlehem and other districts have opted to use collection agencies to get debts from parents. That's troubling to child welfare advocates, especially as a recent United Way study found that roughly 1 in 3 Pennsylvania households struggle to afford life's basic necessities. Donna Cooper is the executive director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth.
The cost of housing, the cost of transportation, the cost of childcare and after-school childcare for children has risen much faster than wages. So families that we think ought to be able to, like their income, let's say they're at $45,000, those families are underwater.
Some parents who would qualify for free or reduced lunch aren't signing up, either because they don't know about the program or they want to avoid the stigma. Advocates say schools should help parents overcome those hurdles with better communication. Even in wealthier districts, communication is needed about lunch debt. In the Pennsbury district in Bucks County, leaders have asked parents to use an app that monitors debt levels in real time. Andrea Deniker is a parent there.
My son is notorious for racking up lunch debt. So unbeknownst to me, we racked up about $50. And I would get an alert on my phone saying that, you know, the account was negative and, you know, how to pay it.
According to National School Nutrition Studies, the number of students going into debt for school lunch has been steadily rising since 2014. Emily Rizzo, Keystone Crossroads.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's first industrial hemp growing season is coming to a close. More than 300 individuals and companies received licenses to grow the low THC version of the cannabis plant this year. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed visited one of them at their warehouse in Beaver County.
You can smell it before you can see it.
There is a noticeable smell.
That's Ed Santillan, CEO of AgriFarm LLC.
I know people that are on the radio can't tell, but what you're smelling today is about only a third of what it really smells like when we first harvest the crop.
We're at AgriFarm's hemp processing facility in Vanport, about 30 miles down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh. This hemp was harvested about 2 weeks ago. Rows and rows of it, stalks as much as 8 feet long, hang from orange plastic netting secured to the ceiling. It smells just like marijuana, but there's one big difference, says Chief Operations Officer John Clay. This hemp has way less THC, the psychoactive ingredient in weed that makes you feel high.
We have less than 0.3% THC in our product versus your standard medical marijuana having anywhere from 15 to 40%.
Clay reaches out to one of the drying stalks and crumbles it between his fingers.
And as you see, the seeds can fall right out as this stuff is drying out. And what we'll do is we'll pick the seeds up and we'll run them through our seed processor.
Clay walks over to one of 3 seed tables. It's basically a big wooden box on legs, filled with the processed seeds, each about the size of a peppercorn. He reaches in and scoops up a handful.
We have approximately 250 pounds of seed in here. And this basically is shed off of these plants, and we haven't even broken the plants down. So, you know, we'll expect to have probably a couple thousand pounds by the time we're done.
Wait, this box right here is 250 pounds?
Yes. Depending on the variety, you're looking at anywhere between 7,000 to 9,000 seed per pound.
Okay, so this is like, I don't know, 7,000
millions of them.
Clay says they won't have any problem finding buyers for these millions of hemp seeds. There was a seed shortage this year, he says, and next year demand could be even higher as industrial hemp programs get going in large states like Texas and Florida. But growing for seed wasn't actually AgriFarm's plan. Initially, they wanted to plant a seedless strain of hemp to be processed into CBD products. But an exceptionally wet spring foiled that plan, so they switched gears. Adaptability is key to survival in this business, says Santillan.
We've talked to several farmers who have had total losses of their crop. It's a learning curve for everyone. I think it's important for all farmers to work together to benefit each other and offer our services to each other.
Santillan has big plans for the future. He wants AgriFarm to one day be vertically integrated, from producing the seeds to growing and drying the hemp to extracting the CBD. And he wants to make those services available to other hemp farmers. He's also in talks with people in Ohio, West Virginia, and Maine about partnering to grow hemp in those states. He's plowed about $500,000 into the venture so far and takes me outside to see some of his biggest investments.
So outside we have our combine and our John Deere 4050 tractor, our babies.
Big babies.
That's right.
Santillan says his business is about more than turning a profit. He says the hemp industry will bring jobs to rural areas like Beaver County, and the products they create have the potential to make life better for people like his wife, who has found that CBD oil reduces her migraine symptoms.
It's exciting. You know, this is the first year that hemp is allowed to be grown as a result of the Farm Act, and everyone that's involved this year has been part of history in the making.
It's a new era, says Santillan. In fact, the chief of police for Beaver and surrounding areas stopped by the morning of my visit. He got a tour of the warehouse, gave the guys some advice on security, and wished them luck. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. He calls it the brotherhood that no man wants to join. American fathers dealing with the deaths of their children, whether they're babies, teens, or adults, when they pass on. Psychologist and retired businessman Larry Drake, and Pittsburgh native, is the author of a new book on the hardship, particularly how it hits African American dads. His collected stories are called Color 'Em Father. Larry, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
I want to start with how you came to this work, your story. Your daughter Kia died after battling sarcoidosis and stomach cancer at age 41. When that happened, what were you looking for in terms of support, advice, comfort?
Well, as a psychologist, you understand the cycles and stages of grieving. However, you obviously can't treat yourself. So I was really looking for literature, something to really help me figure out how I was going to make it through this period. I mean, obviously, the foundation of my life is my faith, but you also need something sometimes more material, something that you can hold on to that is physical in nature. So books and readings and things of that nature were certainly part of what I was looking for. The problem is I didn't find anything.
Mm-hmm. Did the book start out about strictly your relationship with Kia, or did you always want to include others who have suffered similar loss?
No, it never occurred to me to write something just about Kia and I. And actually, the book originally, my original thought was to approach it from an academic perspective, to research, you know, families and individuals, and more specifically, men and how we grieve. But then it came very clear to me that I had 10 other friends who were my personal friends who had suffered a loss. And I decided, why not talk to them? They must feel the same way that I do. And I was in a position where I realized that I had been to the services of many of their children. And I honestly thought to myself, if I knew that it hurt this bad, I would have still been grieving for them.
You already knew them. How difficult was it to convince them to tell their stories?
At first, it was really difficult for some, not so much for others. I found that, you know, once they knew that I was in the same place that they were, that we were kindred spirits in that regard. They were more open to me, and we were friends. That being said, there were several fathers who were part of that original 10, which is why the book only reflects 7, that just couldn't participate. It just was too painful for them.
You were telling your story within 2 years to the death of your daughter, Kia. For some of the fathers included in your book, it's been as long as 25 years since the death of their child. Was it that nobody asked them or they weren't ready yet?
Probably more that they weren't ready. And I'm not sure you're ever really ready to talk about that level of pain. I mean, everyone experiences something like this differently. But when it's your child, which is an unnatural thing to happen to an adult who leaves, the child leaves before they do, we know that that's not the natural order of things. And the other thing is the relationships that these fathers had with their children. We like to say in our collective that it wouldn't hurt so bad if we didn't love them so much. And so we know that we were all very close to them and are still very close to them in many ways.
You write a lot about the brotherhood of fatherhood. How do those bonds manifest, especially for African-American fathers?
You know, obviously, when you talk about something like losing a child and being a father, it really doesn't matter about your culture. Pain is pain. We all would feel that no matter. There's a nuance, though, for African-American fathers, and that really has to do with the history and many of the things that we as Black fathers face in America. There are some natural things with respect to discrimination and not feeling valued and not feeling a part of American society at times that certainly impact the way we father and the way we feel about our fatherhood relationship. So it does impact us differently. We just have a different history here in America than other cultures.
You address what you call the stereotypes of Black fatherhood. What are the misconceptions?
You know, obviously the biggest myth, of course, that we hear so often is that Black fathers aren't present in the home. And certainly our communities would be different if there were more fathers present. Yet it never talks about the thousands and thousands and thousands of fathers who are. And in fact, some most recent research indicates that in many cases, Black fathers are actually more present than their white counterparts. Pew did that research recently, which was startling to some people, but certainly not to me.
So in your mind, what makes a good father beyond providing for your kids?
Well, I think that the one ingredient that I talk a little bit about in the book, but I think one that is very important, is this idea of vulnerability. When you think about vulnerability and as it's defined in the dictionary, it's essentially defined as a weakness. Mm-hmm. But if you really understand the relationship that you have to have with people who love you and people you love, and more specifically your children, vulnerability has to be a character trait that men often can't display because we're socialized not to be vulnerable, not to show any kind of emotion, that we have to be quote-unquote strong. But we actually have to be more courageous to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a character that we need as fathers to spend more time on.
You write in the book, I guess, some advice that you learned from your grandfather about being present, completely present.
Yeah, my grandfather was, he worked here in Pittsburgh at, he spent 20 years at Crucible Steel and then another 20 years in the mines. And he was an incredible guy. He was very quiet and very, very soft-spoken. But when he said something, it really mattered. And he said, you know, the most important thing you can do as a parent is be present, to be there in your children's life, not be distracted by things. And if you fast forward to today's culture and all of the things that we're faced with and all the distractions, being present is really important. In fact, one of our fathers in the book talks about his daughter, Krista, saying to him as he was lamenting to her that he wished so much that he could do more for her. And she said, "Dad, if you could just be present, I'm okay if you're just present." And he said he learned a very important lesson from that. And I think that's a very important lesson that Krista continues to teach us as we make this journey.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest on The Confluence is Larry Drake, author of Color Him Father, a collection of 7 stories from Black fathers who've experienced parental love and grief. The ages of the children included in your book range from 9 months to Kia, your daughter, who was 41 years old at the time of her death. How different were the experiences of the fathers in your book who lost their children at different ages and in some cases under very different circumstances?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say that the experience was the same, which was very interesting. You know, one of the fathers, he lost a 9-month-old and then lost her twin 17 years later. But when you think about those two, he would tell you that the pain was just as much. He was with Janine every day during her time here on Earth, and yet he was with James as much as he could be while he was here. But the loss felt the same when they both were gone.
And you're talking about Lavelle Thornton.
Yes.
The native from the Pittsburgh area.
Yeah, yeah.
He sort of ponders in the chapter about Lavelle and his children. He sort of ponders the question. He asks himself the question, you know, all this pain I've had for all these years because of the death of not just one child, but two.
Yeah.
Would I rather not experience the pain at all and therefore not experience the children or experience the children and the pain?
Yeah.
And his answer was?
And his answer was, I would rather have experienced having the children regardless of the pain.
Yeah.
Because Janine and James made an impression on the world. And that's part of why the book for me and for them was important, because books are written for a time in perpetuity. And therefore, it allows us to have our children live on in the lives of those who engage with the book. And we plan to do other things as a result of the book. So we're excited that our children's lives will be remembered beyond just the time they spent here.
When you set out to write the book, you were looking for something, maybe comfort. But what did you feel when these other fathers shared their stories? Did it help? Or did it renew your own pain?
So, you know, it's a really interesting dichotomy, because I want so much for the book to be successful as it's been thus far. And I want so much for many fathers and many mothers and women to read the book. And that's happened as well. That said, every time I read it myself, every time I talk about it, it's painful. Every time I get on a stage on the book tour and do a panel discussion, it's painful. And someone asked me, they said, so why do you do it if it hurts that much? And I said, because I have to. It's what my daughter would want me to do. As a matter of fact, all the fathers to a person said, we want our children to be proud of us. And that's as good a reason to write the book and do the book and do the tour as any.
It's often said that the parents are their children's first teachers. But what did you learn from your daughter, Kia?
She was incredibly courageous throughout her life. Kia was a free spirit. She was very much her own person, like her dad in that respect. We were very close, very much alike. But I would tell you, she did something that really demonstrated to me how courageous she was. She had come back from surgery, and she had actually had come back from recovery. And she was laying in her room, and I was standing there with her. And she said, Dad, I'm alive. I'm alive. Can you believe I made it through? And I said, yeah, I can believe you made it through. I said, you're going to have an incredible story to tell somebody about how you made it through this very difficult time of somebody taking a tumor out of your stomach the size of two grapefruits and rebuilding your digestive system. And here you are. Wow, that's pretty powerful. But there must have been something when I was talking that she saw in my face that troubled her, because she looked up at me and she says, Dad, you're looking at me kind of funny. Why? And I didn't realize that I was doing it. And I said, well, maybe I'm just responding to all these tubes that are coming out of my little girl. And she pulled herself, and she was all of about 93 pounds by this time. She pushed herself up out of the bed and pulled me close to her. I could feel her ribs on my chest. And she said, Dad, it's going to be okay. And she hugged me. And that was the last time I got to hug her. But it showed me that she was more concerned about me than she was about herself.
Psychologist and Pittsburgh native Larry Drake is the author of Color Him Father. Larry, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. New research from the University of Pittsburgh finds doctors are more likely to prescribe opioid medications after receiving gifts from pharmaceutical companies. That's compared to peers who didn't receive gifts. Joining us in studio is WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden, who spoke recently to the study's lead author. Welcome back to the program, Sarah.
Hey, Kevin.
Sarah, that finding sounds kind of stark. What is it about gifts, whether it's cash, something else, that incentivizes others to act?
Yeah, so I don't think what's happening here is doctors are like, oh, I got a fancy meal, now I'm going to prescribe opioids like crazy. Mm-hmm. I think it's a more subconscious influence that I think we're all, people in all industries are subject to. You know, we talk about implicit bias in education, right, and the justice system, so it's not surprising that this sort of subconscious nudging is also manifesting in medicine.
We hear the horrible statistics about the number of fatal overdoses from opioids. Do we have any idea just how prevalent the prescribing of legal painkillers is, either locally or nationally?
Yeah, so the CDC found that in 2017, there was 58.7 prescriptions per 100 people, which is incredible, but that's actually down from 2020. 12, where the prescribing rate was 81.3 prescriptions per 100 persons. So, I mean, I think it's kind of clear that it's just way too much.
So this study, what led to it?
I mean, we have known or been suspect for a while, and there's been a lot of criticism for a while about marketing practices in the pharmaceutical industry, particularly when it comes to opioids and doctors. And that relationship has always been suspect. And this is actually just one of a couple recent studies finding that there is an association between gift giving and prescription rates.
When was the research conducted? How many doctors were reviewed?
So they've pulled doctors from Medicare Part D,
right,
and looked at over 250,000 doctors from 2014 to 2016. And so they compared the year before the gift was received and the year after.
Was it the key findings? Mm-hmm. Was there a large gap, a large difference between the doctors receiving gifts and then prescribing the opioids versus doctors not taking the gifts?
Well, it depends on the specialty. Mm-hmm. Most starkly, primary care doctors were, I believe it was 3.5% more likely to prescribe opioids when compared to their peers like the year after receiving gifts. And looking at neurologists and psychiatrists, they were up to 13 times more likely when compared to their peers. And that's because, you know, patient populations are different, training's different, practice is different. So it's unclear why between specialties there's such a difference, but it's there.
What kind of gifts are we talking about?
Oftentimes it's meals, sometimes it's speaking fees, travel, education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you spoke to the lead author, was she surprised by the findings?
She was surprised by the difference in specialty, but she wasn't super surprised that this association existed because of what we already talked about with the sort of subconscious nudging.
Mm-hmm. So do the findings suggest some sort of quid pro quo? Gifts equal more prescriptions.
You know, we don't know what the association is. We know that it's more than a correlation. It's definitely an association. But we don't know if the doctors are, you know, again, we don't really know, but we know it's there.
Yeah, there's an association rather than a direct link.
Yeah, so we don't know what way the relationship is going. We don't know if, for example, the pharmaceutical companies are specifically targeting doctors that are already prescribing more opioids or if it's the other way.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
This study was published last week in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. We'll have a link to it on our website at WESA.fm. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we'll talk about the growth and support for employee-owned businesses in the Pittsburgh region. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcast. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.